Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm Ethan Elkind. As the Bay Area grapples with skyrocketing housing costs and choking traffic, what is Governor Jerry Brown and the state government doing to help? What can they do? Tonight, I'm sitting down with Ken Alex, senior advisor to Governor Brown and head of the state's Office of Planning and Research, the agency that helps set land use policy for the state. Charged with serving the governor and his cabinet as the state's long-range planning and research agency, the Office of Planning and Research conducts comprehensive state planning on issues such as land development, water management, energy planning, and local adaptation to sea level rise, among many other issues. The timing couldn't be more critical for California and the Bay Area. Economic growth here is threatened by the lack of affordable housing and traffic congestion. Climate change requires the state to clean up its electricity system with clean technologies like solar farms that now dot the landscape. The state also seeks to transition to electric vehicles with more public charging infrastructure available to drivers. Meanwhile, climate impacts will require cities and counties to plan for more droughts, extreme flooding, more intense heat waves, and sea level rise. So what can the state do to help cities improve planning for these challenges, particularly housing, transit, and energy development? What does the future hold for these issues, and how will these efforts affect larger goals to address climate change? To discuss all of these issues and more, I'm pleased to be joined in the studio by Ken Alex, Senior Policy Advisor to Governor Jerry Brown and Director of the Governor's Office of Planning and Research, the agency that's setting land use policy for the state. And he's also the chair of the state's Strategic Growth Council. Welcome, Ken.
Thanks for having me, Ethan.
Glad you can be here. And, of course, we invite you, our listeners, as always, to join this conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email or text us now with any questions at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us by tweeting us at CityVisionsKALW. Otherwise, we'll plan to open up the phone lines in just about 20 minutes. So in the meantime, what do you think the state's planning priorities should be? Please do let us know. So, Ken, let's start with the obvious question here. What exactly is the Office of Planning and Research, and why should Californians be aware of what it does?
It's a question I get a fair amount. It's a funny name for a government agency. It sounds like a throwback to the Soviet Union. We can start doing five-year wheat harvesting plans or something. But in fact, like a lot of things in California that have an environmental connection, it was signed into law by Ronald Reagan when he was governor. And the idea of it is to really have a state voice in planning. I think most people think of planning as very local. Local cities and counties tend to have the most say in planning issues. But there are state interests, particularly in the age of climate change, as you mentioned in your opening. How do we use things like how do we site renewables? How do we site infrastructure for electric vehicles? How do we make a balance between development and open space? These have state implications, and part of my job and the job of the Office of Planning and Research is to really think about how those interact with the local priorities and how the state can help local entities and how we can provide state guidance.
And so what kind of specific authority does the Office of Planning and Research have? Or I assume it's carved out in statute in certain places, or is there particular areas where it really sets an important policy guidance for the state?
It's pretty broad. The statute, it is in statute. It is in law. It's created by law, as I said. It's signed into law by Ronald Reagan. It has very broad goals, like a lot of things in the state. It talks about sustainability and health and all kinds of things that we'd like to see for the state in terms of well-being. But in terms of its actual authority, also like a lot of things that are written into statute broadly, it's fairly limited. It's not a regulatory entity. It does have some fairly specific obligations. So everything that has to do with the California Environmental Quality Act, which is the law that gives rise to environmental review of projects, the Office of Planning and Research has something called the CEQA Clearinghouse. So all of the CEQA documents go through my office. We also produce something called the General Plan Guidelines, which is basically how local jurisdictions write their local constitutions, if you will, general plans or the plans for local governments going out, looking out into the future 20 years or so. We provide guidance for how local governments do that. There's a series of other things that we do, but they're really fairly broad. Like we have statutory obligation to be the liaison to rural communities, for example, and we have some connection to tribal issues and a whole bunch of other things. But as I say, it's not a regulatory function. It's more of an advisory role.
Mm-hmm. And I noticed in your title, you're also senior policy advisor to Governor Brown. So what part of your job duties involve that as opposed to your job duties with the Office of Planning and Research?
Well, the Office of Planning and Research is part of the governor's office. So my job gets mashed together. It's a fairly typical Jerry Brown idea that you give people more than one title so they do more work. But
so we're getting our taxpayers' dollars worth out of you.
That has always been his theory. So I see them pretty much as one job. I have a little bit more time that I spend on climate issues in particular that may go a little bit outside of land use. But if you think about it, pretty much every environmental issue, including climate change, land use is a very big part of it. Mm-hmm. And so I tend to work them together. As we might talk about a little bit later, one thing that I do that is probably not in the bailiwick of Office of Planning and Research is around some international work that California has been involved in on climate, particularly as the Trump administration pulls back the federal role. I think the state will probably take a more extensive role working internationally because the climate issue is such a global issue.
So in addition to these hyper-local issues of planning, you're also taking on these international efforts. Do you want to just take a moment to describe what that's looked like? Are you sort of functioning as a Secretary of State for California?
Well, as you might imagine, you know, most of our effort in California is about what happens in California. That's what our taxpayers expect. That's what we do. But because of climate change, it has a worldwide profile. And so California needs to participate in a worldwide way. We're 1% or less of global emissions of greenhouse gases. But we have 900 miles of coastline. We have snowpack that may turn into rain and therefore impact 30% of our water supply. We have increasing forest fires. Lots of issues in California that climate change exacerbates. So California can't simply sit back and say, well, the federal government will take care of it. Unfortunately, they won't under the current administration. So we've spent quite a lot of time and effort, and when I say we, it's a pretty small group of folks. It's probably four or five people in the administration. And we put together something called the Under Two Coalition, which has turned into a fairly big coalition of about 170 or so subnational governments, states, regions, provinces, entities that are smaller than countries, that want to have more of a voice in the international process. We can spend a fair amount of time talking about it, but that's the general idea. These are the entities, the subnational governments like California, that want to do more, that think that sometimes the national governments are not doing enough, that they're going too slowly, and that states like California can be more nimble and act more quickly to really take on climate change challenges.
And this may be more timely, particularly if Trump ends up pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement, than an international agreement like this, or I guess a subnational agreement like this, could be of more relevance and importance then.
Yeah, I think that's very true. We want to provide an alternative voice. There are 10 states, 10 U.S. states that are part of the coalition and 11 cities. We expect there'll be a few more over time. Actually, worldwide, the 170 or so subnationals that I mentioned represent over 35% of world GDP. So it's quite a substantial group. And it includes entities you know, from rainforest states and developing economies to the largest industrial states in Europe. It's got a number of Chinese cities and provinces, a couple of in India. So it's really a worldwide effort, and California has been one of the big leaders of this effort. And as you say, if the Trump administration, as they appear to be doing, pull back from the Paris Agreement, you know, we want to provide an alternative voice and reflect the fact that there's another view in the U.S.
And is there an economic potential benefit at stake here for California? In other words, if some of these other subnationals sign on to what California is doing, is it thinking that maybe this provides an opportunity to sell some of our products or our services to these jurisdictions in terms of clean technology and things like that that reduce greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, we think that overall, California will benefit and already is benefiting from response to climate, not just from the aspect of taking care of the public and taking care of our state. But we're building the 21st century economy. You know, when you look at the Trump administration and the actions they're taking to prop up the coal industry, it strikes us here in California as an effort to move back to the 19th century, which just seems antithetical to what we stand for as a country and as a state. So as we move forward and we build the 21st century economy with energy efficiency, with renewables, with, you know, things like Tesla and batteries, you know, it's going to build an economy that California will be proud of and that will work for the next century. So working with other regions around the world, we think that's going to be ultimately beneficial. It's not a straight line. It's not linear. There are always hurdles. There are economic and other challenges. But ultimately, this is the best thing to do for the future of the state.
Well, I know your office sounds like it's involved in so many of these issues. I wanted to ask about one thing in your title. So in addition to being senior policy advisor to Governor Brown and director of Office of Planning and Research, you're also chairing the Strategic Growth Council. So I wanted to, you know, ask particularly for listeners, but just for myself, what exactly is your role in the Strategic Growth Council, and can you explain what the council does?
So I just collect titles. The Strategic Growth Council is, you know, it's kind of funny. It's a similar answer in some ways to the Office of Planning and Research. It's another thing created by statute. This had a particular idea. This was not signed into law by Ronald Reagan. It came after his time. But the idea is, I think, very correct, that government can become extremely siloed. So the transportation agency works within its own domain, and the California EPA works in its domain, and the Natural Resources Agency, and they often overlap, and they don't know it, and they don't talk to each other. So the idea of the Strategic Growth Council was sort of twofold. One is, it put together seven state agencies at the cabinet level, and then three public members, with the idea that they would work together across agencies, particularly on issues around sustainability of moving forward for the state. And a lot of that is around land use. And so that's a big part of it. And the second part of it was to really move into a regional notion of how to sustain California. So it dovetails quite extensively with a law called SB 375, which was an effort by the legislature and by the governor to have planning as we move forward to be more regional in nature. I mentioned that most planning is done at the local level, cities and counties, but there are big challenges that are regional, and transportation and housing and jobs are among those regional challenges. So the Strategic Growth Council, part of its charge is to try to help that regional approach to sustainability and to planning.
And that's what something we mentioned in the opening, that I think for a lot of Bay Area residents, two of the biggest issues are skyrocketing housing costs, you know, rents for homes eating up a huge percentage of people's budgets, but then also traffic congestion. And I think SB 375, as you're describing, is an effort to address those. Can you describe how some of the work that you do, either through the Office of Planning and Research or Strategic Growth Council, you know, helps the state further those goals and addresses those concerns that a lot of people in the Bay Area in particular have?
Yeah, well, the first thing to say is they're profound problems, and the Strategic Growth Council and OPR are not going to solve them magically. So there are a series of efforts that are part of the puzzle. So I don't purport to have the answers to all of these things, and if I did, I probably would have a different job. But look, the idea is to really think about what do we want in our future communities? How do we have the right balance between housing and transportation options? How do we preserve open space and farmland? And how do we do it in a way that creates vibrant communities with opportunities for people of different income levels, both for housing and jobs? And so what we do a fair amount of, we have a couple of programs that are grant programs that give actually some hundreds of millions of dollars to local communities that are really aimed at promoting the connection between transportation and housing. We've found that when you have housing located near transportation options and retail space where people can walk and bike and get to services locally, that it creates all kinds of benefits for the community and for the individual. It actually turns out that people are healthier when they have the chance to walk, and that creates more of a community sense, and that creates greater safety. And so there's a whole bunch of benefits to trying to combine those things. And, you know, San Francisco is a place where there's been a substantial effort to have that kind of development. Some of it is working. Some of it, as we know, San Francisco is challenged by extremely high prices for real estate and difficulties in building affordable housing. So the mix is probably not where people would like it. But there are also some excellent examples in San Francisco of the connection between transportation and housing that has made lives better. So that, you know, we can talk quite a bit about this, but that's a start.
Mm-hmm. No, that's helpful. And you mentioned that the Office of Planning and Research is responsible for administering the California Environmental Quality Act, for releasing some of the guidelines. And for listeners, that's the abbreviation there, CEQA, California Environmental Quality Act. And that's the sort of the from a project proponent perspective, that's the red tape. That's the, you know, the environmental safeguards on one hand, but also the bureaucracy and the paperwork that slows projects down. So given that we are trying to build more housing, particularly near transit, and we're also trying to build transit projects, bike lanes, things like that, that also get sometimes delayed by CEQA review, what is your office doing, what is the state doing to try to streamline that review while also preserving the things about CEQA that a lot of environmentalists in particular care about?
Yeah, this is a difficult balance and a very controversial issue. I've been working on CEQA. In my previous job, I was the head of the CEQA unit at the California Attorney General's office, so it's a subject I know a fair amount about, and I know quite a bit about the controversy. What I would say is there are things that we can do to improve the process and that we are doing. One of the biggest efforts right now is under a law called SB 743. It's a fairly obscure concept, but I think it's going to make a very big change. So to try to do this quickly and concisely, there's something under CEQA where if you build a project and you impact what's called the level of service, and in layman's terms, I think the most direct description would be that you've created traffic delay, then you have to take certain actions to undo that traffic delay, usually by widening streets and adding turn signals and stop signs and if you think about it, almost every project in an urban area is going to have an impact on traffic and traffic delay. And most projects that are in areas that are called greenfields out in the suburbs, they will likely have very little impact on traffic delay, at least initially. And so that creates a weird incentive to actually build projects in greenfield areas and in undisturbed areas because you have to do less work around traffic. And it's a disincentive to create projects in what we call infill areas, in urban areas. So 743 changes that by saying we should have a measure that looks at how many vehicle miles the particular project adds to the local region. And so my office is working quite a lot and has been over the last couple of years to create a regulatory system around a vehicle miles traveled concept to allow projects that are built in infill areas and transit areas to do less review because we know that traffic is bad and that we want to promote options around transit.
So that sounds like an important change, even though it does sound, you know, obscure, I guess. But I know that there have been some projects that have been held up for a long time just based on that impact alone. So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Our guest tonight is Ken Alex, Senior Policy Advisor to Governor Jerry Brown and Director of the Governor's Office of Planning and Research. We invite you to call in with any questions or comments that you have for Ken. What do you think the state's planning priorities should be? So do you have a question for Ken? Please do call to join the conversation. That number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And we're opening the phone lines now. If you don't feel like calling in, you can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org. or post a comment on KALW.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter by using @CityVisionsKALW. So we look forward to any of your questions or comments. So I wanted to get back to this topic of CEQA review. And there was a bill that passed a number of years ago that allowed large projects, over $100 million projects, to basically get fast-tracked CEQA review. And I know that your office was involved to some extent in kind of determining that those projects could meet the criteria laid out in the law. I'm wondering if you could talk about some of the ones here in the Bay Area that have been able to take advantage of that for listeners who are curious about how CEQA impacts on the ground with real-life projects.
So that was a law called AB 900, and what it did for projects over $100 million, it allowed some streamlining of the judicial process. If somebody sues under CEQA, the judicial process needed to be very quick. And that was appealing to developers because a lot of times the delay caused by CEQA is because of court cases. So these projects had to meet some very strict criteria. They had to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. They had to be certain types of projects. And as I say, they had to be over $100 million in size. The idea was to promote economic growth. And they also had to be in areas that were basically already had a lot of development. The two in the Bay Area that people will be very familiar with, one is the Warriors Stadium in downtown San Francisco, and the other is the Apple headquarters in Silicon Valley, both of which are well over $100 million, created a lot of jobs, and had some level of controversy in each instance. But they took advantage of the process, and in fact, the Warriors is particularly interesting. They were sued, and the process was fast-tracked through the judicial proceedings. The Apple headquarters was not sued on, so they didn't really need the fast-tracking.
Mm-hmm. And on the subject of sports stadia, this is something that I think may be of interest, particularly not just because the Warriors are in the playoffs, but because it looks like the Raiders are bound for Las Vegas. We may open up some development opportunities at the Oakland Coliseum site, and it sounds like the A's are also interested in a downtown stadium. So from a sort of OPR hat perspective, what is your take on sports stadia and what they can do for downtown environments.
Well, I think the idea of sports arenas has changed. It used to be, and we see it in Oakland, it's just a stadium somewhere with a parking lot. And now I think we have the Giants Stadium in downtown San Francisco, and the most recent example is the stadium of the arena in Sacramento for the Sacramento Kings in the NBA. These are combination facilities that are really combining retail space and housing. And they're much more than just a stadium that's used a few times a year. So from a development perspective, from an urban redevelopment perspective, they seem to be really in line with the kinds of things that we want to see in some urban areas. They can be controversial. The Warriors Stadium, obviously, there's been a fair amount of controversy given its location near some medical facilities. But they also are about a much broader sense of development and community that I think the old idea of stadiums when I was a kid and growing up was just a place you drive your car to and then go to the ball game. That's changed.
Mm-hmm. And so I imagine if a stadium were to come into downtown Oakland, that could, for the A's, that could really, really transform things with that investment there.
Well, I think that's the idea. Certainly the plans that I've read about are an effort to incorporate a whole series of retail and housing space, and I think that's why Oakland is so interested in it, and I think that's some of the frustration over losing the Raiders.
Mm-hmm. So I got a question on my Facebook page around housing, and last year the governor had proposed buy-right housing, where projects basically could get, similar to what you're talking about with expedited CEQA review, how certain housing projects could get sort of immediate approvals if they complied with some local restrictions. So that effort by the governor last year didn't go anywhere, the buy-right housing approach. Does the governor have a particular housing approach that he's pushing this year, or are you involved in any of the discussions along housing in the legislature?
So there's something like 100 bills pending in the legislature around housing, and I think as the legislature session continues, we'll see more focus on that. The governor continues, not surprisingly, to be very concerned about the housing situation. I think what he put forward last year continues to be part of his thinking. Obviously, it didn't make it through the legislature, so it's going to have to be changed in some form, and we'll see where it goes. It's probably too early to know exactly what the emphasis will be, but I think it's what happened in the process last year will kind of give some of the parameters and some of the thinking.
Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to ask about transportation and transit investments. We just saw, for those who were following the news last week, I think it was, or maybe the week before, the legislature passed with a supermajority, 2/3, raise gas taxes, vehicle license fees to pay to repair our existing transportation infrastructure. Does OPR have a role in any of that? Are you involved in the transportation discussions? And what do you see going forward for the state on that issue?
Yeah, so it required a 2/3 vote in the legislature. Some courageous legislators, I think, in many ways, because it's not an easy thing to vote for a gas tax. I think none of us enjoy paying that tax. However, we do enjoy driving on better roads than what we have now and having better infrastructure. So a lot of what the new law is going to fund, first of all, it requires what's called fix it first. So the idea is that existing infrastructure and roads, that's going to be the primary focus rather than building more roads. So that's a big deal. And second, there's quite a bit of funding for public transportation, for what's called active transportation, making walking and biking easier. So OPR does get involved in a fair amount of that, as does the Strategic Growth Council, which you mentioned. And we will try to really make our grants through the Strategic Growth Council dovetail with the work being done and that's being funded by the transportation bill. And we will try to tie it together also with housing options that are connected to transportation options so that we build cohesion. That's the idea of the state planning office, is to have a little more coherent set of policies.
And it looked like the Bay Area is getting some immediate dividends from that bill, as I saw that BART was considering some service cuts, you know, ending their 4 to 5 a.m. service, and then got a cash infusion, I think, with this transportation dollars, you know, providing the, those dollars and for the area here.
Yeah, it looks like, as a result, that will at least delay fare hikes that might have come otherwise. So that seems like a good win for the Bay Area.
So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Our guest tonight is Ken Alex, Senior Policy Advisor to Governor Jerry Brown and Director of the Governor's Office of Planning and Research. Phone lines are open if you'd like to call in with any questions or comments. And the number to call to join this conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org, or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. So, Ken, you just mentioned grants. Where does the Strategic Growth Council get that grant money, and how is it programmed out for communities that want to, you know, do things on transit, on housing that will benefit the state and the, you know, the economy and the environment of the state?
Yeah, the money comes from what's called the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. That is directly funded by the cap and trade program that was set up to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. There about 25% of the emission reduction in California is the result of this cap and trade process that applies to large industries like oil refineries that have to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. They can buy credits in an auction system, and that raises some hundreds of millions of dollars that goes into this greenhouse gas reduction fund. Those dollars are then spent to try to reduce greenhouse gas emissions further. And so the Strategic Growth Council has three primary programs, I would say, to give away that money in the form of grants. The first is called Affordable Housing, Sustainable Communities. The second is called SALC, and I'm going to forget what it stands for, but it has to do with sustainable agriculture. And then the third is something called Transformative Climate Communities, which is a really innovative program in which three communities will get a significant chunk of money. One community in Fresno this year will get $70 million. A community in Los Angeles will get $35 million. And then a third community, which we haven't determined yet, will get $35 million. And the idea with that particular program, I can talk about all three, but let me just start with Transformative Climate Communities. The idea of that program is to do the things that we've been talking about for the last half an hour, which is to combine transportation and housing and something called green infrastructure, and to put it all together in a community that is right now in the bottom 5% of disadvantaged communities in California, and to try to help do investments to turn around the economic and civic fortunes of that community. It's a really interesting program. We've got a number of foundations and banks and private sector interest in this, and we're hoping to leverage a lot more funding for those communities.
So it sounds like it could be an interesting way to do some economic development in addition to some environmental protection in some of these communities then.
Well, our theory is that they go hand in hand, that you can't have one without the other, that simply spending money in a disadvantaged community to fix some environmental problems will not get us the change that we need. The idea of transformative change here is to build economic opportunity, and that means jobs and infrastructure and transportation and housing all together.
So let's go to the phone lines. We've got some callers coming in. First is Larry from Fremont. Larry, welcome to City Visions. You've got Ken Alex from the Brown administration standing by for your question.
Thank you very much. The one thing I would like to see for stadium being built is access to public transportation. The thing I really like about the Oakland Coliseum is that it has a BART station right at the Coliseum. I also think that the Levi's Stadium did a pretty good job of providing access to public transportation. So what are we going to do to try and convince the people who are building the stadium to provide a nearby public transportation stop for the stadium? I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, thank you, Larry. So, Ken, what are these stadium developers doing on public transit access?
Yeah, so part of AB 900, one of the criteria to get the streamlining that we talked about earlier is to really improve transportation. It had to be, I forget exactly now, I think it had to be 10% better than the best transportation site in the league. So when we looked at the stadium for the Warriors and there was another one in Los Angeles, we had a look at the transportation options. And the requirement was that it had to be significantly improved from the league overall. We see that in the Sacramento arena. I think the Warriors are doing a good job on that. As you mentioned, in Oakland, you can go to the game on BART, which is pretty great. And we couldn't agree with you more. We think that the transportation to Levi's Stadium has not been as good as I think some of the Bay Area would have hoped. And hopefully we'll learn from that and have many more options.
So thank you, Larry, for that question. Let's go back to the phone lines. Hugo from San Mateo, welcome to City Visions.
Hi. My question is here. First, I want to detach myself from the sports arena because I think the Levi's Stadium was a disaster. The problem is that I live in San Mateo, we're getting overcrowded. So the state is getting really greedy and the county is getting really greedy of constructing new offices, and that's generating some good revenue. But I don't see any infrastructure going around it. We just are getting more and more difficult to drive around, and we're getting more and more permits. So I think that is a contradiction that we are raising the taxes to create infrastructure, but at the same time, we're getting more revenue because we're creating the problem that we need more infrastructure. So I disagree. Even I'm a Democrat and I voted for Brown. I think that we are not playing right here.
So in other words, so Hugo, it sounds like you're frustrated that we're seeing a lot of new buildings coming in, but not the same investment, corresponding investment in infrastructure, and you're frustrated about taxes going to have to pay for that or increase in taxes, if I'm hearing you correctly. But let me throw that over to Ken Alex to respond.
Yeah, it's a fair criticism, and it's something we're struggling with. The cost of building infrastructure, as you know, is quite substantial. We think that the transportation bill that Ethan mentioned earlier is going to start to change that. We're also extremely interested. It's an area where we think California can work with the Trump administration. They've made a lot of comments about $1 trillion investment in infrastructure from the federal government. We'd like to see some of that come to California. But I think your point is well taken. Our infrastructure has gotten behind, and we need to really update it. That's part of what we're after. And I will say that one of the things that we're doing at the Office of Planning and Research in light of climate change is to really think about how do we integrate resilience and adaptation functions into every infrastructure dollar so that when climate change impacts grow, sea level rise, flooding, drought, et cetera, our infrastructure is built to withstand that so that our investment lasts.
I definitely want to ask you about some of those guidance around sea level rise in particular and other ways that the state is helping locals plan for that. But on this point, we got an email from Denise in San Francisco, and Denise says, like a balloon blowing up, too much will make it burst. The idea that we should endlessly grow is absurd. Not a word about carrying capacity like sewer lines, water, fire protection, road accidents, high-rise escapes during earthquakes, pollution, cars, etc. cetera. I imagine you probably get common concerns like this when we talk about growth, particularly growth in urban areas. What's your response?
Again, it's a really good observation, but we have a reality we have to deal with. Right now, California is 39 million people. We estimate by 2050 we'll have 50 million people. So we're adding the size of, among the largest states will be added again to California in the next 20, 30 years. So what do we do about that? One of the things that we really look to do is to think about how we preserve farmland, how we preserve open space for future generations, but give people the opportunity to live in the state. We're not in a position where we're going to tell people they can't move here, and we probably don't want to do that anyway. So we have to accommodate it. And so we think that the best way to accommodate population growth is primarily in urban areas, to increase some of the density that's often controversial. But we think that there are ways to do that that benefit the community and that provide all kinds of options.
So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Our guest tonight is Ken Alex, Senior Policy Advisor to Governor Jerry Brown and Director of the Governor's Office of Planning and Research. The number to call to join in if you have any questions for Ken is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment on our website at kalw.org or on our Facebook page. And you can also reach us on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. So, Ken, see, another email came in here from Susan, who is a former San Franciscan. She says she's now living in Emeryville, where the housing is more affordable, and she wants to know, what will it take to get a BART station built in Emeryville, and asking how residents can help make this become a reality. Now, I know you don't sit on the BART board of directors, but I think the question goes to, how do we expand transit access for more communities, particularly in urban areas where we do have density? Where do you see the state going on that question?
Yeah, so one thing that we talked about early on was this idea of moving to a vehicle miles traveled concept. And one thing that will do is, as new projects, housing projects, retail projects, et cetera, as they're built, they need to mitigate the impacts of additional miles traveled that are created by those projects, cars that people own that either drive to the project or to and from the project. And one way that you mitigate that is to expand public transit options. So, for example, a development might pay into a regional fund that could then pay for light rail. So that's why I thought, I think that this is going to be quite a substantial change and something that San Francisco is actually in the state probably the leading city working on that concept.
Mm-hmm. So thank you, Susan and Denise, for those email questions. So going back to something you mentioned about sea level rise, you know, a lot of this stuff isn't all that far away. I mean, we're talking about maybe a 5-foot sea level rise by the end of this century. What is the state doing to help local communities prepare, not just for that, because not everybody lives on the coast where that might really be a direct issue, but for all the other things that we are expecting to have happen, from more flooding to more, you know, oscillating to more droughts, heat waves, all those kinds of things?
Yeah, it's sometimes it's very hard to get your head around the coming storm, if you will. And you know, it's a little bit frightening in a way, and I think all of us are worried about what the changes will mean. But I think from California's perspective, what we want to do is to take actions now that will ease the transition, that will allow us to adapt and to be resilient. So to that end, the Office of Planning and Research is actually required by law now. We just had a new law passed last year to work with local governments and to work with a series of regional organizations that are focused and dedicated to looking region by region at the state What are the impacts that are going to be the primary challenges of climate change? So along the coast, obviously, sea level rise is a big deal. Storm surges will be a big deal. What we see now, interestingly enough, we had 5 years of drought, and now we have the wettest year on record in the 100 years of record. What's going to happen in the spring is we've gone from drought, and now we're going to have some real challenges with our flood control. So how do we think about the regional impacts of exactly those kinds of big swings? So we're working region by region. We're working on flood control systems and changing how they operate, changing how levels of reservoirs are controlled. That's a big deal. How do we ensure that we capture enough water, particularly in groundwater, for recharge from runoff that's going to happen earlier and earlier? How do we deal with the impacts of heat in the Central Valley on people, on crops? So all of this is a series of works in progress, and it's something that my office is daily working on.
So let's go back to the phone lines. Philip from San Francisco, welcome to City Visions. You're on the air.
Thank you. I think the best way to protect the Bay Area from sea level rise is to build a smart green barrier under the Golden Gate Bridge that performs a number of functions, including protecting the whole Bay Delta in Delta region. It would also generate power, generate fresh water, and you use just modern state-of-the-art green design and you know, to allow, you know, fish ship transport and all this sort of thing. I think it makes far more sense than trying a piecemeal or retreat approach all over the bay, and done cleverly, it could be a real boon to probably the easiest area to protect in all of North America due to the Golden Gate Bridge entrance to the bay.
So, Philip, sounds like you've done some thinking about sea level rise in the Bay Area. Ken, what's your response to this idea?
Well, it's a little outside of my expertise, but I will say it's a little bit reminiscent of what happens on the Thames River in England, where they do control the level and flow of the river, and it's very dependent on a series of gates. So it sounds like that's something like what you have in mind. Whether that's feasible and viable is well outside my expertise.
So you're not paid by the state to be an engineer, but set policy. So fair enough. But thank you, Philip, for that question. It's an interesting idea. So, Ken, I wanted to ask you, Governor Brown now has served, you know, one term, and he's, I guess, in 2 years into his second term, so we got about a year and a half or so left. What are some of the big goals that you see for the administration and for your office in particular?
Well, I'll start with me. I'm always careful about speaking for the governor. He's notoriously, has his own counsel, himself and his wife often. For me, we started our discussion talking a little bit about some of the international work that California is doing around climate. We really want to institutionalize California's role in the international process. We think it's really important given the global nature of climate change. So that's a big goal for me. Another is something we've been working on for quite some time, which is how do you better use data in state government? And we live near Silicon Valley. We have all kinds of incredible companies and startups that are doing amazing things with data, and the state government is not always on the cutting edge of that. And so one of the things that we've been working on is how do we create something that I like to call a California mosaic, where we can put together data on just about everything in land use and related, and then make that available not only to government decision makers, but to the public. And so you know, there are probably 10 or 15 other things I'd like to get done. We're very interested. We haven't talked about autonomous vehicles and what that might mean for California. We oftentimes are subject to what technology does, and then we react in government. I think we'd like to think through a little bit about what autonomous vehicles might mean for the state before it actually descends upon us. You can imagine a future where you would have every child in America with their own autonomous vehicle being driven around place to place, and that creating all kinds of detrimental impacts. Or you could imagine a situation where autonomous vehicles mean that you no longer need very many parking lots, that you have autonomous vehicles that carry multiple passengers, that people in communities that haven't necessarily been able to have connectivity with public transit and being able to get to jobs might have a better ability to connect to the economic opportunity. So those are some of the things we're working on. There's probably quite a lot of others and not enough time.
So a lot of issues you just mentioned there that we could spend a while talking about. We actually have done a show in the past on self-driving cars, so that's definitely a topic of interest I know our listeners have heard from. So I just want to remind listeners we've got about 10 minutes left. If you want to call in, we do have the phone lines open. It's 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can ask Ken Alex, the governor's senior policy advisor, your questions. But in the meantime, we do have an email from Bruce who says that there are no vacancy control regulations, which allows large multi-unit building owners to sit on vacant available apartments to prevent having to rent to low to moderate income potential tenants. And he says, now because the governor won't fund affordable housing, legislators are going to hamstring the taxpayers with a $1.5 billion bond. I think he's referring to a bond for affordable housing, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong on that, though. Do you have a response to Bruce on that?
Well, the governor's view is that subsidizing affordable housing by payment is about the most expensive way to create housing, and it creates very, very few units. And so that's going to be part of the discussion in the legislature this year to figure out the best way to do that. I am not a housing expert. That's actually not the focus of OPR for the most part. So I don't want to get too far into it, but it's a big issue. I've heard the governor talk about it many times, and he has a very strong view as to why, as a former mayor of Oakland, that he doesn't feel that that's the best way to spend public money to generate more housing. And I am, as I say, I will defer to the governor.
Sounds like a smart position to take. So you mentioned autonomous vehicles. What about electric vehicles? Where is the state going on that? How does land use play a role in electric vehicle adoption?
So electric vehicles, we have a executive order signed by Governor Brown that calls for 1.5 million electric vehicles on the road by 2024 or 2025. I'm forgetting. I think maybe it's 2025. We're a little behind our initial target on that. We have about 250,000 vehicles right now. It's a challenge. California is right now about 50% of the market for electric vehicles in the United States. So we're doing far, far better than the rest of the country. We'd like to see it move more quickly. And to get there, it's an interesting dance because you have to have the infrastructure to support the vehicles, but you don't want to get the infrastructure too far ahead of the vehicles. So right now we're in an inflection point because the manufacturers are moving from cars that tend to have range in about 100-mile area, and now we're about to move it up to over 200 with the new Tesla and the Bolt and the Leaf and the BMW car. So I think we're going to see a pretty big change in the market that also impacts the level of infrastructure needed. And so we're trying to get the investment right on both, and we also want to promote the idea of the electric vehicle itself. We have an idea that we'd like to get 10 million test drives in California over the next few years so that people have the experience of what an electric vehicle is like. Everybody that we talk to who's tried it thinks that they're great. And so we want to see that expand and get to our 2.5 million by 2025.
And I wanted to maybe close, since we got about 5 minutes left or so, with the topic that you referenced earlier about the change in the federal administration. And obviously now we have a federal administration that's hostile to a lot of what California is trying to do, not just on climate change, but potentially on transit investments, things like that. So how has that changed your job, and how do you see the state responding in the areas that you specialize in?
You know, it hasn't changed my job that much. I mean, we had a climate change challenge and series of problems before the Trump administration. We have them during the Trump administration, and we'll have them when Trump is gone. And California was a leader before. We're going to be a leader in this administration, and we'll continue that leadership, I'm sure, after Trump as well. So those things remain the same. Having said that, the United States is unquestionably important, and the Obama administration was unquestionably important to getting the Paris Agreement, to making progress on climate, to getting China and India to move more progressively to dealing with this. And we really do not want to lose that momentum. So California needs to execute well. California is the fifth or sixth largest economy if it was its own country. If we can meet the climate change challenge in California, I think that will show the world that you can have a very sophisticated, large-scale economy that can continue to operate and grow even as we make the changes necessary. That's a really big deal, I think, moving forward in the world. And we need to have a voice that is alternative to the Trump administration that shows what a large-scale economy can do in collaboration with the rest of the world. So those are the things that I think are different that we're going to work on, that we're going to really spend some time pursuing.
And as I mentioned, we've got about a year and a half left of the last fourth and final term of the Brown administration. When you look back, what do you think are some of the big accomplishments? Not that your tenure is over, hopefully, or ushering Governor Brown out, but what are some of the things that you look back and think have really made a big impact in your line of work in the administration?
Well, I think you have to start, when Governor Brown took office, we were over 12% unemployment. We were well below 20% in terms of percentage of renewables on our electrical grid. We were, economically in difficult position. So in the last 6.5 years, we've cut the employment numbers in half. We have an economy that is in full-on transition. We're very close to 33% renewables in our system, heading to 50% in the next 10 years. We're starting to make very significant changes to how we provide electrical power, how we do transportation, how we think about transportation and housing connectivity, all the things that we just talked about today.
Great. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guest tonight has been Ken Alex, Senior Policy Advisor to Governor Jerry Brown and Director of the Governor's Office of Planning and Research. Ken, thanks so much for coming in and spending this time with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thanks to all of you for joining me and Ken this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was Damian Miner. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb and Kendra Klang. And join us next week as we discuss ways to end aging and prevent age-related diseases through advanced research. So that should be an interesting topic. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night, and have a great rest of your week.